Coming up on Star Stuff, planet Earth's close encounter as an asteroid the size of a house soars past just 8,000 kilometres above the ground. Growing confidence that after 33 years of flight, Voyager 1 is about to reach interstellar space. And more evidence of a liquid subsurface ocean on the tiny Saturnian moon Enceladus. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Planet Earth had a close shave on Monday, with a house-sized space rock passing just 8,000 kilometres above the planet's surface. To give you an idea of just how close this asteroid was, it actually soared past closer to the ground than the altitude at which telecommunications satellites orbit. Closest approach was at 23:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time. That was off the coast of Antarctica on Monday evening. 2011 MD was only discovered on June 22nd by the LINA robotic telescopes in New Mexico. They scanned the skies searching for near-Earth objects or NEOs, asteroids and comets, which could pose a danger to our planet. Initial estimates placed the size of this asteroid between 18 and 45 metres. The asteroid's trajectory gave sky watchers in Australia and New Zealand the best view of the NEO as it streaked across the sky from the north to the southwest. As it crossed Australian skies, it was about 8,000 kilometres up, shining with a magnitude of about 11.6 to 12 and clearly visible with a decent-sized backyard telescope. Its flight path also took it over the Americas, the Pacific and Eastern Asia. But as Les Dalrymple from the Powys Museum Sydney Observatory explains, it was the people of Australia who got the best view.
Yeah, well, we had an asteroid that sort of really just buzzed over our shoulder so close that, it's metaphorically, if you sort of can imagine you're on a cricket field and you feel that whistle of a cricket ball go past your ear by an inch or so, we kind of sort of felt that. This very tiny asteroid, which has got a designation, it's just a number, 2011 MD.
Tiny, it's the size of a house.
Yeah, well, probably, yeah, around about the size of a house.
I suppose everything's relative, but...
Exactly, around about 25 metres in diameter, maybe a little bit smaller than that, flew past the Earth on Monday night at a minimum distance of only 8,000 kilometres. Now, that actually brought it inside the orbits of a lot of geosynchronous satellites. That gives you some idea how close it was. And it sort of rushed from one end of the sky to the other over the course of around about 5 hours. So if you were out on Monday night with a telescope, as I was, it sort of went from the moderate northern sky down to over the southwest horizon around about 2 a.m. in the morning. Just in the course of around about 5 hours, it traversed that huge chunk of sky. It's moving in an orbit that brings it quite perpendicular to the direction of the stars that move in the night sky. So, you know, it was really quite an event, and it really zipped past very, very quickly. Its closest approach was not observed, actually, because it occurred in daylight, around about at a point where the Falkland Islands are in the southern Atlantic Ocean.
So between Antarctica, South Africa and South America.
Yeah, that's right. So that particular part of the Earth was in daylight when this particular large rock sort of rocketed past the Earth. So we didn't see that point, but the lead-up, the 3 or 4 hours, which is the lead-up to the point of closest approach, were really well seen in Australia when the asteroid looked like a very tiny 12th or 13th magnitude star that was very slowly tracking across the sky in a skew angle, if I could put it that way, to the direction of stars in the eyepiece.
Now, the scary thing about these sort of things, of course, are that often we don't know they're there until very near the event. In this case, it was just a couple of days earlier that we first found out about it. In fact, you rang me about it to warn me about this event on Friday.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, objects this tiny, obviously enough, reflect, because of their size, reflect so little of the sun's light that our capacity to even see them with really large telescopes doesn't really come into play until they get really close.
When you think about it, Les, it's really only been in the last decade or so that we've really known about asteroids before we see them, that they're coming, because prior to that famous comet Shoemaker-Levy, which slammed into, well, in various pieces, slammed into Jupiter, there was always that debate as to whether or not asteroids and comets really do pose a serious threat. I mean, astronomers have always known that, but it took Shoemaker-Levy and the Earth-sized holes that left in Jupiter for politicians to realise and actually put money towards that sort of thing.
Yeah, and drive that point home, exactly right. And I mean, these things have been buzzing past the Earth for eons, for centuries, but our capacity to detect them really only came about in the early 90s. And since a number of these near-Earth asteroid research projects have got underway, there's around about five or six of them around the world at the moment, looking for rocks that are on orbits that intersect the Earth, we really didn't know about them. And there were doubtlessly thousands, even in, you know, the last couple of hundred years, that passed near the Earth and went completely undetected because nobody knew to look for them. But of course, now we do. And I mean, there was one in 2008, which was discovered about 3 days before it got here, that actually impacted the Earth. And that was only a few metres in diameter, and it came down harmlessly.
So this particular one, 20 metres in diameter, what have you, size of a house, if something like that were on a slightly different angle and it hit the Earth rather than simply went through the upper atmosphere as this one did, what sort of damage would that have done?
In all likelihood, an object of this size would have exploded very high up in the atmosphere. And in fact, almost certainly it would have exploded very high up in the Earth's atmosphere, 30, 40, 50 kilometres up, due to differential expansion caused by the extreme heating, by friction with the Earth's atmosphere. As it slams into the Earth's atmosphere, the outside heats up extremely quickly, and because that's a different rate of expansion to the inside, it just simply would have exploded and all the pieces would have come down pretty much harmlessly.
Unlike Tunguska, I guess.
Unlike Tunguska, which was a much, much larger body apparently. They estimate that that one was in the order of 500 metres in diameter. So we're talking, you know, nearly a couple of orders of magnitude larger than this body that zipped past the Earth on Monday night.
And of course, for those people who aren't aware of it, Tunguska was what we believe was an asteroid that airburst over the Tunguska region of Siberia just over 100 years ago now. It literally flattened hundreds of square kilometres of forest.
Yeah, that's right. It was either an asteroid or it may even have been a small comet that burst several kilometres up in the air. And we were quite fortunate that it burst over an area which was one of the most least inhabited on Earth. There were very few people killed, but as you say, there were hundreds of kilometres of forest and structures and all sorts of things.
It's that flattened like matchwood.
Raised to the ground, yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, the glow from that airburst was visible a third of the way around the world in London.
So yeah, pretty spectacular. You know, putting that in context, this little body was probably nearly two orders of magnitude smaller.
That's Les Dalrymple from the Powerhouse Museum Sydney Observatory and a contributing editor to the journal Australian Sky and Telescope. Scientists analysing new data from NASA's Voyager and Cassini spacecraft have calculated that Voyager 1 could cross over into interstellar space at almost any time now. A report in the journal Nature indicates Voyager 1 could be much closer than previously thought. The new claim is based on data from Voyager's low-energy charged particle instrument. Last December, it reported that the outward speed of charged particles streaming from the Sun had slowed to zero. The stagnation of the solar wind continued through until February, making a thick, previously unprecedented transit zone at the edge of the solar system. Scientists combined the new Voyager data with previously unpublished measurements from the ion and neutral camera aboard Cassini's magnetospheric imaging instrument. This collects data on neutral atoms streaming into our solar system from the outside. The analysis indicates that the boundary between interstellar space and the bubble of charged particles the Sun blows around itself is somewhere between 16 and 23 billion kilometres from the Sun, with the best estimate being a distance of approximately 18 billion kilometres. Now that's interesting because that's about where Voyager 1 is now, meaning it could make the historic crossover into interstellar space virtually any time now. Voyager 1's now covering about 540 million kilometres a year, according to Mission Control at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Her sister craft, Voyager 2, isn't quite as far out, just 14 billion kilometres from the Sun. Earlier this month, JPL reported new observations by Voyager suggesting the edge of the solar system may be filled with a turbulent sea of magnetic bubbles. The new data suggested magnetic field lines from the Sun are broken up into self-contained disconnected structures. The field lines are stretched outward by the solar wind, the stream of charged particles emanating from the Sun. Scientists think they could be interacting with material being expelled from other stars in our region of the Milky Way. Last year, NASA scientists said a giant ribbon of subatomic neutral particles discovered by the IBEX spacecraft in 2009 were in fact solar wind particles being reflected back into our solar system by a galactic magnetic field. Launched from the Cape Canaveral Air Station in Florida in 1977 on a grand tour of the outer solar system, the twin Voyager spacecraft have been on a 33-year journey. They are humanity's farthest working deep space sentinels and about to become the first man-made objects to reach interstellar space. Saturn's strange ice moon Enceladus may have a salty ocean lurking beneath its frozen surface. A new study reported in the journal Nature by a team of scientists, including Dr. Frank Potzberg from Germany's Max Planck Institute, helps explain the icy liquid plumes of water spewing out from the tiny moon, possibly forming one of Saturn's majestic rings. The discovery comes from data gathered by NASA's Cassini spacecraft, which has been studying the Saturnian system since 2004. Named after a Titan who stirred a revolt against the Olympian gods, Enceladus is a tiny world just 504 kilometres wide. It's encased in a dazzling white shell of ice that's pristine, except for deep light blue ridges near its south pole that look like tiger stripes. These tiger stripe features emit geyser-like sprays of water vapour and ice grains, spawning the idea of a subsurface sea lying beneath the moon's frozen ice sheets. The new study examined Cassini data recorded during three passes through the enigmatic plumes, including one just 21 kilometres above the moon's surface. Cassini's Cosmic Dust Analyzer instrument monitored grains of ice as they struck the sensor plate, often at speeds of up to 18 kilometres a second. Potzberg and colleagues found grains further out from Enceladus were relatively small, and they were mostly pure water ice, matching shiny granules in Saturn's E-ring, which traces the moon's orbit around the planet. Now, in contrast, grains found closer to Enceladus are larger, and they're richer in potassium and sodium salts. They found that 99% of the mass of the tiger stripe particles comprise these salt-rich grains, but they tend to fall back onto the moon's surface rather than making it out to the E-ring. Potzberg and colleagues say this points to a liquid salt water source rather than simple ablation from Enceladus's icy surface. That's because salt water freezes slowly, and as it does so, the salt is literally squeezed out, leaving pure water ice behind. So had the grains come from surface ablation, there should be very little salt in them, but that simply wasn't the case. With Saturn being so far away from the Sun, ambient temperatures in the ring system are a chilly minus 273 degrees Celsius. So, where's the liquid water coming from? Why isn't it all frozen? Well, Potzberg and colleagues believe the water's being kept liquid because the tiny moon's geologically active thanks to tidal heating, generated by the competing gravitational pull of Saturn and two nearby moons, Dione and Janus. They hypothesize this friction's warming an ocean, probably lying in a layer about 80 kilometres beneath Enceladus's crust and in contact with the moon's rocky core. That's where the salt's coming from. When the moon's outermost icy layers crack open on the tiger stripes, the reservoir is exposed to space, and the drop in pressure causes the liquid to evaporate into a vapour, with some of it freezing into salty ice grains that form the plumes. Now, if this is correct, it means two essential elements for life as we know it, liquid water and energy, exist on this distant rock from the Sun. Planetary scientist Dr. Andrew Prentice from Melbourne's Monash University believes the study neatly explains the most likely cause for the Enceladian plumes.
This paper is coming from a German fellow, Postberg. The Americans, they've got a different view that these plumes are actually driven by sort of tidal rubbing between adjacent glaciers that are near the South Pole. There's the moon goes in an eccentric orbit, and there's a bit of rubbing going on between the walls of these glaciers, and that's tidal energy is spewing all these particles into space. And so they were looking at, have been pushing an origin that doesn't require an ocean. Surface of Enceladus is pretty well pure water ice, and the rings are mostly pure water ice, but there is some contamination, and there is certainly they've seen about 6% of, maybe up to 6% of the ring detections show that there is potassium and sodium there. But it's only a small concentration. It's only about 1% by mass. So how did it come about? The most likely scenario is probably the one that's been put forward by Postberg and his co-authors, namely that in the beginning, by whatever ever means, Enceladus did have a liquid ocean. In fact, in my model, I have Enceladus forming as a great water world. It forms so close to Saturn. It goes right back to the very beginning when Saturn was throwing off these gas rings, and they were pretty warm and balmy. There were temperatures up around 300, and they're very dense, and any condensates that form, traditionally we think of all the condensates and planetesimals being rocks, but in fact in that part of the close to Saturn where the pressure was so high, the actual water would directly condense as liquid. So Enceladus, when it formed, it had a rocky core, a pod, making up about something like 50% of its mass, and then this was surrounded by a big ocean. But that would have, it's a small satellite, it's only about, it's got a radius, I think, of something like 250 kilometres, a diameter of 500, and it would have long since cooled down. Saturn's a very old planet. It's, you know, it's 4.5 billion years old. It's older than the Earth, and in my gas ring model, the Jupiter would have formed ahead of the terrestrial planets, and Saturn is even older than Jupiter. But Enceladus is in an awkward position today. It's trapped in a resonance with Dione, another moon, and it is quite possible that there are some tidal stresses that are working to create this down at the South Pole. They're all converging, and there's a stress point there. And I think everyone is happy with the idea that the tiger stripes are tidally induced, frictional event. Although Enceladus sort of should have long since frozen out, somehow it's able to sustain it looks like it's not an ocean, but there's a large pool of water down at the South Pole. And I think the nice part about this paper by Postberg, by allowing it to be very salty or salt rich, the salt depresses the freezing point. So although there isn't that much heat being produced, having the salt there acts as a sort of an anti-freeze agent, and it allows these, it's probably only a small pool, it's probably only, maybe 20, 30 kilometres across, only a fraction of the radius of the moon, but this pond is being, and there's tidal stressing down there, and it's being sufficiently heated to cause these great jets that go off into space. So I think these guys are right.
That's Dr. Andrew Prentice, an astronomer and planetary scientist with Melbourne's Monash University. US physicists are still unable to confirm the findings of an atom-smashing experiment that, back in April, was touted as possibly having discovered a new force in nature. The initial findings caused a buzz in the scientific community. There was heaps of speculation as to whether some new elementary particle, maybe even the Higgs boson, has been detected. But the D-Zero collaboration at the US Department of Energy's Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory say the bump in the data found by the collider detector at Fermi Lab simply could not be replicated. In fact, scientists have looked at some 200 trillion particle collisions, but simply haven't seen the excess reported by CDF. In fact, it's now been revealed that scientists have spent more than a year studying what appears to be a bump in the data in Fermilab, which operates the Tevatron particle accelerator. The Tevatron was the most powerful atom smasher in the world. That was until the Large Hadron Collider went online at CERN, the European Organisation for Nuclear Research. The European Space Agency's cargo ship, the Johannes Kepler, has burnt up during re-entry in the skies above the southeastern Pacific Ocean. The Automated Transfer Vehicle, or ATV, was sent on a deliberate suicide death plunge. After finishing its mission, delivering 6.6 tons of food, water, oxygen, experiments, supplies and other equipment to the International Space Station. The robotic freighter was then filled up with several tons of trash and waste from the space station and sent on a steep descent from orbit designed to allow it to burn up at an altitude of about 80 kilometres, high over the Pacific Ocean. Components made out of stainless steel and titanium are usually the only debris which survives the heat of re-entry. Splashing down in a specifically designated uninhabited zone in the South Pacific, well clear of the normal shipping and air routes, about 3,000 kilometres east of New Zealand. The Johannes Kepler was the second of five German-built ATVs designed to supply the space station. Launched back on February the 16th from the European Space Agency's Kourou Launch Centre in French Guiana on Ariane 5 rocket, the 10-ton ATV is designed to automatically navigate its way to the ISS and dock with the space station. During its visit, the Johannes Kepler was also used to boost the International Space Station up into a higher orbit. During three intensive reboost manoeuvres, the cargo ship pushed the 417-ton orbital outpost from an altitude of 345 kilometres up to 380 kilometres. The manoeuvres are needed because the space station loses altitude as it orbits due to atmospheric drag. Almost nothing remains of the Earth's atmosphere at 350 to 400 kilometres, except some very faint wisps of gas molecules. Sparse as they are, they're still sufficient to cause the space station's orbit to decay steadily unless it's periodically reboosted to higher altitudes. In the past, boosting the space station to higher orbits of about 400 to 420 kilometres used to be routinely done by the space shuttle during each visit. In fact, Space Shuttle Endeavour performed the same reboost back on the 29th of May. But the end of the shuttle program means other spacecraft, such as the ATV, or perhaps a Russian Progress cargo ship or Soyuz manned capsule, will need to take over these responsibilities. So the European Space Agency's ATV fired her orbital correction system's 8 thrusters on 3 separate occasions after Endeavour's departure in order to lift the space station. The first boost, on June the 3rd, only lifted the ISS by about 3.8 kilometres. But the remaining two boosts, each lasting a massive 75 minutes and using 1,400 kilograms of propellant, did the rest of the job. A pause between each burn was needed because of the way Kepler's fuel system pumps propellant and also to let the thrusters cool down after each firing. Once that job was done, Kepler was undocked from the space station and prepared for its deorbit burn and suicide plunge back to Earth. As it began its fiery death plunge, it made one last phone call home to help improve future controlled destruction operations of this kind. You see, an onboard recorder gathered data on location, temperature, pressure and altitude as the ATV disintegrated and then ejected from the dying spacecraft, transmitting the information back home through the Iridium satellite telephone system during its descent. The Johannes Kepler was named after the German mathematician of the Age of Enlightenment. The first ATV flew in 2008. It was named after the 19th century French trailblazer of science fiction, Jules Verne. The next, to be launched in February 2012, will be named after the 20th century Italian physicist Eduardo Amaldi, and the fourth will honour the man of the millennium, physicist Albert Einstein. The fifth and final ATV is yet to be named. Meanwhile, a Russian Progress cargo ship has successfully docked with the International Space Station 2 days after being launched on the Soyuz rocket from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan. The Progress M11M is carrying 2.6 tons of supplies, including fuel and water, for the 6 Expedition 28 crew members aboard the orbiting outpost. China's launched a new telecommunications satellite from its Xichang Space Complex in southwestern Sichuan Province. The Chinese-built DFH-4 ChinaSat-10 satellite was blasted into space on a Long March 3BE rocket. The 57-metre-tall three-stage Long March 3 launcher used four extended strap-on liquid-fueled rocket boosters, as well as an extended first stage in order to lift the 6-tonne satellite. 26 minutes after liftoff, the satellite was placed into a highly elliptical geosynchronous transfer orbit. The orbit is a perigee of 180 kilometres and its apogee is a massive 42,100 kilometres. Eventually, the satellite's own onboard thrusters will carry out a series of burns to circularise the orbit at an altitude of about 35,000 kilometres above the equator. The ChinaSat 10 replaces the ChinaSat 5B launched in 1998 and should have a lifespan of about 15 years. And time now on Star Stuff for a look at the rest of the week's science and technology news with a science report. New research suggests toddlers who use fewer hand gestures often go on to develop autism. The study by the Murdoch Children's Research Institute found autistic kids aged between 8 and 24 months often don't use as many hand gestures as other children. The study looked at the behaviour of 1,900 kids. Lead researcher Carly Venice believes the findings could enable health professionals to diagnose autism in children earlier.
It is important to diagnose autism as early as possible. That way we can get them into early intervention sooner. And we know early intervention is the best way of helping these kids to develop their skills as best as possible.
Japanese scientists have developed a self-propelled endoscope designed to swim through the human digestive tract. As the ABC's Mark Willacy reports from Tokyo, researchers say the new device will help in the detection and early treatment of cancer.
Nicknamed the Mermaid, the endoscope is shaped like a tadpole and can propel itself through the digestive tract. Fitted with a camera, the tiny device can capture images inside a person's stomach and colon. Doctors use a joystick to control the endoscope's movements, and it can examine the digestive canal from the esophagus to the colon in just a few hours. Mark Willacy, ABC News, Tokyo.
New research has shown a drug used to treat heart failure can also slow the effects of snake venom. The ABC's Noni Walsh reports on a story which isn't a load of snake oil.
The long-held belief that snake venom kills directly through the bloodstream is wrong. It's carried by the lymph system. Dirk van Helden from the University of Newcastle says an ointment used to treat heart failure can impede the venom's progress.
Applications of a topical ointment containing a gas called nitric oxide was very useful in slowing lymph flow. It slows it about 300%.
The research published in Nature Medicine shows that immobility is still very important to slowing the poison. And Associate Professor van Helden says not to forget the pressure bandage either.
Scientists in California have, for the first time, devised a way to accurately measure the body temperatures of dinosaurs by examining their teeth. Chemical analyses of Jurassic period fossils from two sauropods, they're the long-necked, long-tailed dinosaurs that look like Fred Flintstone's pet dino, show that these dinosaurs were about as warm as most modern mammals. Reporting in the journal Science, researchers found the key was finding out at what temperatures some rare chemical isotopes, carbon-13 and carbon-18, would combine. It just so happens these same chemical isotopes are found in the teeth of Brachiosaurus and Camarasaurus sauropod dinosaurs. And it turns out the temperature of Brachiosaurus was measured at 38.2 degrees Celsius, while Camarasauroids registered a temperature of 35.7 degrees C. Of course, debate continues as to whether the temperature was actually due to the creatures being warm-blooded or simply because their gigantic size generates lots of heat through work. A Japanese supercomputer has become the fastest in the world, achieving a speed of 8.162 petaflops. In other words, it's achieved a staggering 8.162 quadrillion calculations per second. Now, that's more than three times faster than a Chinese rival, which held the previous record at 2.566 petaflops. Even more amazing, the new Japanese computer, called the K-computer, is still being configured. It's been undergoing assembly in Kobe since October, and in fact won't be fully complete until June next year. But that sort of computing power does come with a hefty price tag. In this case, the computer alone is worth $1.4 billion. Still, it's got quite a bit of hardware. Try 672 computer cabinets equipped with 68,544 CPUs. But wait, there's more. When finished, the machine will have more than 80,000 CPUs and should be able to operate at around 10 petaflops. But the K computer may find it hard to hang onto its crown. There's intense competition coming from the United States, which is now seriously looking at the idea of a, believe it or not, 1,000 petaflop supercomputer. Serious crunching power. And for more news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. If you missed it on radio, don't forget Star Stuff is available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, and heaps of other media we couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. Now that's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol followed by ABC Star Stuff all as one word and in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.